From CAFE, welcome to CAFE Insider. I'm Preet Bharara.
And I'm Ann Milgram.
Hi, Ann.
Hey, Preet. Happy birthday.
Thank you. I turned 31.
Yeah. I'm still 29, although our five-year-old said last year, doesn't this mean you have to be 30 now? Math is a bad thing.
Perpetual 29. So I noted that you went to another aquarium.
We did.
Where'd you go?
We went to the Georgia Aquarium, the largest aquarium in the Western Hemisphere, I think, and definitely the biggest aquarium in the United States. And it's an amazing aquarium with four whale sharks and four manta rays, among other things.
Okay, so I was not so interested in those things, but I was interested, based on the conversation we had, I think, last week, your analogy about penguins and stealing penguins. Did you steal a penguin? You tweeted, I think, about stealing a penguin.
I did tweet about a penguin, but I did not tweet about stealing a penguin. We met this penguin named Charlie, who just turned 33 this past summer, which is kind of an extraordinary thing for a penguin, an African penguin. They usually live to about 18 or 20.
Wow.
And Charlie's also had the same mate for more than 20 years, and he is awesome. So I tweeted out a picture. But let me just say, he's still in the Georgia Aquarium where he belongs, safe and sound.
Was there any quid pro quo with the penguin?
in exchange for taking his photograph?
Well, I don't know, military assistance or something. Did Rudy Giuliani have anything to do?
He did not. There was no money that was exchanged. There were no military assistance and no criminal investigations.
Do you think the penguin would be a good personal lawyer to the president?
better than Rudy, you mean?
Okay. That's my segue into this week's program. And by the way, you know, we laugh, and I think most people appreciate it. There's no way you and I can get through life and the news unless we can laugh a little bit, even though obviously so much of this is deadly serious and painful and terrible, especially something that we probably will not get into much here, the situation with Turkey and Syria.
Yes, that's right.
So we have two broad things to talk about this week. We have all the developments with respect to impeachment. Then we have the developments with respect to Rudy and some of his associates who were charged by the SDNY. Those two things are actually not totally separate. They're connected to each other. First, on impeachment, there was this letter from the White House counsel's office to the congressional committees signed by the White House counsel, Pat Cipollone, that has been roundly trashed, in which they basically said, the White House said, they were not going to cooperate with impeachment in any way, shape, or form because there hasn't been a full vote in the House. So three people, two of whom I believe are still with the government, all have defied the party line from the White House. Fiona Hill, White House advisor on Russia, Gordon Sondland, the ambassador to the EU, and Maria or Masha Yovanovitch, who was the ambassador to Ukraine, all decided they want to come forward and talk to Congress. What do you make of all that? What do you make of the defiance?
So I think that's a great question. And I think if I could just go high level for a second as we get into what's happening and as we see people from government testifying, you tweeted out, I think it was last week or maybe the week before, that you sort of thought all of this was unraveling for the president and that the dam was essentially about to break. And I think I would just sort of say high level, I think that's right. And I think that every day we're seeing more information that both corroborates the whistleblower, that there was an effort by President Trump and the administration to essentially exert political influence to get Ukraine to do an investigation into Biden and into the 2016 election. And now we're seeing all these sort of threads of it both come together and get exposed. And so just to put that really high level, I think you sort of called that we were going to see just a torrent of information and news, and we're seeing it. So about these people coming forward, and one of the things that's really interesting to note is you have this White House counsel letter, and I agree with you. The whole argument is it's not fair to the president, and this is a due process violation. The president should get to call witnesses. You know, it's sort of all these things that are actually not true, but sort of arguably on its face, something that a lot of people might say, oh, yeah, that makes sense. But it's really just an effort for the administration to try to say, like, wait, you're not being fair to the president. There's no basis in law for that. The United States Constitution gives the House of Representatives complete authority to conduct impeachment proceedings as they see fit. And so that's what's happening. So enter into this. You've got this letter saying no one's going to cooperate. And then you've got members of government. And you're right, two have already testified under subpoena and a lot more scheduled to testify this week. These people are coming forward. And there are a couple of points worth making. One is that at the end of the day, these folks, in my mind, are being very courageous because the White House is saying, we don't want you to testify. And the president is the head of the executive branch. At the same time, another branch of government, Congress, is issuing lawful subpoenas, basically compelling people to show up. And these individual employees are put in a really tough situation. They're either going to say no to the president or they're going to say no to Congress. And here what we see are people are they're showing up for Congress and they're honoring lawful subpoenas, which compel them to appear and to testify.
You know, I have no doubt that there's this conflict going on in these people's minds. It is true that with respect to Gordon Sondland, for example, who's one of the people who was engaged in that texting back and forth, and we'll get to that in more detail in a second, he was asked to testify, flew all the way in from Belgium, I believe, and at the last minute, the White House said no, issued this letter. Then the Congress issued him a subpoena, after which he said he's going to testify. And he's testifying on Thursday. So it took a subpoena. And I guess the other thing that I wonder is, what, if anything, can the White House do to somebody who decides that when in receipt of a subpoena, they're going to come testify? I guess they could be dismissed.
Yeah. I mean, I think the consequence is that you could be fired, obviously not directly by the president, but Secretary Pompeo could basically say, I'm firing you, I'm reassigning you, I'm suspending you, any of the sort of negative performance actions. Now, here, I think these folks have really good arguments that they are akin to whistleblowers, right? They're coming forward to provide information. They've been asked, they're compelled now. And that's the importance of the subpoena. And we should talk about this for a second, because what Congress has done throughout this investigation at the beginning was to basically put in requests for testimony and documents, basically going to members of the State Department and former government officials and saying, please show up, and giving everyone a chance to voluntarily come in. Now, that's a polite way to do it. It's a very respectful way to do it. But it actually, there are a number of problems with it, including the fact that you end up in this situation where if it's just a voluntary request and you balance that against the president of the United States and the White House counsel saying, we're not cooperating, no one should go, the voluntary request kind of has to be declined, right? Your boss is saying, don't do it. Whereas a subpoena is a lawful compulsion to appear and to cooperate, which feels to me really different. So I think the question preaches.
Right. Although subpoenas have been defied also.
Yes, and they could be defied, and then Congress would have to go to court. But if you were sitting in the committee, would you, I mean, wouldn't you just put everyone under subpoena?
Yeah. I mean, I think sometimes for optics purposes, you want to not look like you're being heavy-handed. And as an initial matter, I mean, we do this often, you ask for voluntary testimony and you see if they're going to play ball or not. And if not, you're perfectly willing to issue a subpoena. Sometimes witnesses, when I was in the Congress too, would say, look, I don't want to look too eager to come in, the lawyer would say, but I'm not going to defy a subpoena. So as an initial instance, why don't we get rid of the middleman and jump straight to the subpoena? And that's all fine, too. You know, there's this concern that lots and lots of people wouldn't come forward. And, you know, for a while, I think they have been held at bay. But there is something about this, whatever metaphor you want to choose, straw breaking the camel's back or the dam breaking or the camel breaking the dam. or the dam breaking the camel. I don't know what you want to call it. But, you know, things do have a certain kind of momentum. You had the one whistleblower. We haven't heard a lot about the second whistleblower. Maybe there'll be more of them. But I think people will sense, not to, you know, happen upon yet another metaphor, they sense a ship sinking and they want to be on the right side of this. So, you know, maybe we should get to the most dramatic testimony that's most recent. Yesterday, October 14th, this woman that probably most people had never heard of, who, you know, didn't work in the State Department, worked in the White House as a Russia advisor, Fiona Hill, said a lot of stuff. And bear in mind, you know, we only have some selective statements from these bits of testimony that people have given. And maybe if you have the full transcript of everyone's testimony from the last few days, maybe a slightly different picture will emerge. But it's hard to understand how differently the picture will look when you hear her reporting that someone like John Bolton, who was briefly the National Security Advisor, I think he was the 17th or 18th, right, National Security Advisor to the president, following in the immortal footsteps of Michael Flynn.
Right. So Fiona Hill is quoted in the New York Times as having said that Bolton told her, quote, I am not part of whatever drug deal Sondland and Mulvaney are cooking up, referring to Sondland, the ambassador to the EU, and Mulvaney, who's both the acting chief of staff and head of OMB.
And didn't she also say that Bolton referred to Rudy Giuliani by a particular kind of munition?
Yes. She said that Bolton said to her, quote, Giuliani's a hand grenade who's going to blow everybody up. And she quoted now, Bolton as saying that during an earlier conversation.
Do you agree with that? Do you agree with that metaphor?
Do you know what's so interesting? I know there are a lot of metaphors today. I was thinking about this last night, and it sort of goes to this conversation about people coming forward and the momentum. But I do think it's a little bit like you know, you can read about Watergate and you can think about what Archibald Cox did, what John Dean, like you can think about how would you have fallen in those circumstances? What would you have done? And what's amazing is that these people who work in the White House and the State Department, and obviously probably also the Office of Management and Budget and the Pentagon, they're literally, they're living this and they're making these decisions as these events happen. And what is extraordinary about this is that, and Fiona Hill left before, she left the White House. She was there since 2017. She left before the July 25th call between Trump and Zelensky, the Ukrainian president. What's amazing, though, is that if what's reported is accurate, and we have no reason at this moment not to believe it is, Bolton literally stopped a meeting and stood up and said no more because he was so troubled by this quid pro quo deal that was going down between the White House asking for Ukraine to be involved in the political election. And so what's really important about that is it's not an outsider, it's not a whistleblower from another government agency. It's literally the president's handpicked head of intelligence for the United States of America, right? The John Bolton has an incredibly high level position picked by the president. Conservative, long-term Republican who basically says, I can't be involved in this. This is essentially a crime. And he calls the flag and he cares so much about it that he has Hill go to the White House counsel, the deputy White House counsel in charge of national security, a guy named John Eisenberg, and report it to him and then do a follow-up meeting with him. And so
it's a constant trend here that you have people who I don't think are generally heroic people and who have a lot of problems, whether you're talking about Don McGahn, the former White House counsel, where he had lines that he would not cross. And I think in many ways he was a disastrous White House counsel and did not do well by the country in some ways. And here, the idea that you and I are sitting here applauding John Bolton because he had a particular line that he would not go past, given, you know, the rest of some of his bellicose language and attitudes and, you know, a little bit of craziness in some of his views, that even he, who thought that presidential power should be very, very broad and interpreted very, very broadly, even a guy like him thought, this is a bridge too far. And as you say, not a whistleblower, not someone from the outside, someone from the inside. And also begs the question that we should think about in the larger context. Why do people like John Bolton come into the administration knowing what the president is like, knowing how the president conducts himself? And then why, on the other hand, is the president hiring people like this, knowing that they may clash because these people don't last very long? I mean, it's not sort of central to impeachment. It's not central to the scandals that are unfolding. But it is, I think, central to, you know, how this White House is run and what further defections you're going to see going forward. And if John Bolton's planning to himself come in, I think, you know, the logical next step is to have John Bolton come and testify and confirm and corroborate what Fiona Hill says he said, which I expect he will do, at which point...
What about the White House counsel lawyer? Do you think there's any chance he'll come in?
I don't think so. I mean, not so long as he is the White House counsel, but you are seeing lots of folks that I never expected would come forward, coming forward.
How important do you think this is? I mean, I think there's two sort of ways to see the Fiona Hill testimony. One is legal, how important it is for the impeachment investigation, and the other is political, how important it is to the sort of national conversation and public sentiment about it.
I think public sentiment is critical. Look, my position in looking at the Ukraine scandal is, on its face, based on what you have so far, based on the admissions of the president, based on the limited readout of the call between President Trump and President Zelensky of Ukraine, notwithstanding all these other figures coming into play and other plot developments and arguments being made, it is very, very simple and doesn't need to be complicated. The President of the United States asked a foreign leader to investigate a political rival. That's it. So when you're having, you know, when folks are having their dinner party discussions or water cooler conversations or debates among friends and neighbors, don't get distracted from this main point. That on its face alone, fully corroborated, conceded, admitted by the president on national television, is an impeachable offense. Then you have all these other layers, which help to sway public sentiment even further, because the quid pro quo, to the extent it can be proven, makes the first offense that I'm talking about much, much, much worse. I think it's bad just to do it on its own, but if it was in connection with withholding aid or withholding a White House meeting, then that's deadly, I think, to the president's case. And so Fiona Hill, who's somebody who's worked in public service for a very, very long time, who has no reason to have her credibility doubted, although I'm sure she'll be the subject of character assassination also, each additional person who talks about this shadow foreign policy and talks about this clear concern and danger of the quid pro quo, and we'll get into Gordon Sondland in a moment, it makes it just harder to say, oh, well, the whistleblower made something up. When you have person after person after person saying these things about whom other public servants and journalists can report, that they have reasons to be found credible, I think public sentiment shifts. And the only way impeachment is going to have an impact, and the only way there's going to be a change in the minds of some Republicans with respect to a almost certain trial in the Senate, is public sentiment.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like Fiona Hill's testimony is devastating, period. If you put John Bolton on top of it, and if he does come in and testify, you're talking about the president's hand-picked national security advisor who the president trusted to do that job saying this. And I think that that ultimately has to carry weight. At least it carries a lot of weight in my mind that it's not just now that we're looking at this from the outside saying there's a problem. It's someone in real time trying to stop this from happening and essentially saying, I can't be a part of this. I'm not in this. This is wrong. And that's really, really important long term, that it's not a political act by the Democratic Party now to try to tarnish the president and undo the election. It was always wrong. And the president had people around him who he'd hand selected who knew it was wrong and tried to report this at the time. And that to me is really, really important.
You know, the other thing that harms the president's arguments and his credibility is a little bit of evidence comes forward and they look at that, and you've seen defense lawyers do this, right? And they defend against it and say, well, look at all these other things that are missing from this, or look at all these reasons why this is not nefarious. And so one argument they've made all along is, well, you see this texting back and forth between Bill Taylor and Gordon Sondland, and Gordon Sondland wrote this text, which maybe you should remind people of in a moment, where he basically said, you know, the president has been very clear. He doesn't want a quid pro quo. And the president himself tweeted about it as if that's his defense. Well, now it appears, we don't know yet for certain because he hasn't testified yet, but based on reporting and people who are familiar with his testimony are saying that Gordon Sondland will say something in particular that I think is harmful to the president about that texting. So remind folks what the exchange was.
Yes. So going back, we have what's been made public is the text message that William Taylor, who was the acting ambassador to Ukraine, had sent to Sondland saying, quote, I think it's crazy to withhold security assistance for help with a political campaign. And then that's when Sondland, according to public reporting, called President Trump, and talked it through with him. And then Sondland, hours later, responds to Taylor's text and says that the president doesn't want a quid pro quo, didn't want anything from Ukraine, and then basically says, let's do the rest of this offline. Like, let's not talk about this anymore. Let's do it by phone. And so there's a couple layers of this that I think become so important, Preet. It's what was pushed out yesterday by an affiliate or a colleague of Sondland. And so they put out some public information over the weekend, which was that Sondland would say that he'd been working at the direction of Rudy Giuliani to secure what Trump wanted, which was a public statement from Ukraine to investigate corruption. And this argument was going to be that it wasn't corrupt, that they basically just wanted Ukraine to agree to investigate corruption in exchange for a meeting, I think, at the White House and these conversations. So on its face, I would have said to you that what Sondland was going to testify to on Thursday, and I think, keep in mind, the question I'm going to ask you at the end is Sondland still going to testify Thursday? Because I'm wondering whether he will. So Sondland was going to basically come in and say, I didn't know there was anything going on that was wrong. I didn't know about the investigation of the Bidens and Burisma, all that. You know, I just knew that we were trying to sort of get Ukraine to do more on corruption. On its face, it is not credible to me, Sondland's argument, because he has been working on Ukraine with Volker and Taylor. Taylor makes an explicit reference to this quid pro quo. It's very clear from the conversations and the text from Volker that Sondland is a part of these ongoing conversations and aware of it. And he calls the president. So something makes him say, uh-oh, I got to figure out what to do, and then to call the president to figure out how to respond. So I wrote these notes last night saying, there's no way this is right, right? Basically saying, there's no way that Sondland's telling the truth. And by the way, on its face, it's already corrupt because you have Giuliani, who's involved in administering the foreign policy of the U.S. You've got Burisma, who there's some indication that Sondland knew about Burisma. There was no argument that they should be investigated again. And you've got the president of Ukraine refusing to sign that statement that the White House wanted basically about corruption because he didn't think it was right. He thought he was getting involved in an election. So Sondland had to have known. Now, what happens yesterday with Fiona Hill's testimony is that she put Sondland in the room during a lot of these conversations. And so I think the problem now for Sondland is that you know, Sahlin's in the same room that Bolton's in, and Bolton puts a flag on the play and says, no, this is wrong, to the extent that he has her report it to a White House lawyer. So how does Sahlin now come in and say, you know, hear no evil, see no evil, speak no evil, I was involved in this, but I had no idea what was happening?
Yeah. So here's the problem for Gordon Sahlin, right? At a minimum, he is no longer a wonderful character and fact witness for the president's side, if you credit what people say he's going to testify about. And that is very simply the text exchange that we spent a lot of time on and other people spent a lot of time on, where Bill Taylor, the former ambassador to Ukraine and then acting ambassador to Ukraine, says, I can't believe we're going to condition this on that. And then Gordon Sondland waits a number of hours and then has a very sort of rehearsed and legally written text in response. And as you point out, we now know that in the intervening hours, he talked to the president, and basically the president, according to Sondland, dictated that. That means that Gordon Sondland no longer seems to be adopting as his own understanding of affairs that there was no quid pro quo. He's like, the president said it. I can only say that it's true he said it, not that it's true itself, which if he says that is kind of, you know, an astonishing thing, distancing himself from the president. As you also point out, as often happens with witnesses who are a little bit in the soup, he at the same time wants to minimize his own activities and minimize his own involvement in all of this. And as you point out, it's not that believable. I mean, he's the one person in this group who really has no diplomatic experience. He's a hotelier, rich guy, gave $1 million to the inauguration committee for Donald Trump, gets an ambassadorship to the EU. Unclear why he's even involved in any of this. So are his hands dirty? Yes. Is he trying to clean his hands now? Yes. And I think sophisticated people, reasonable and thoughtful folks who are trying to sift the evidence and look at the different pieces of testimony and the facts can come to their own conclusions about what you can credit with respect to Gordon Sondland and what you can't. I don't think you need to throw out everything. I don't think you need to accept everything. But it seems, I think, significant that the fact that he wants to distance himself from this idea that there was absolutely clearly no quid pro quo, and rather he wants to say, I didn't know that there was this stuff going on, signals the significance of his concern about the quid pro quo, right? So
yeah.
Like the one guy you thought that was going to come to the aid of the president
yep.
is distancing himself, where everyone else is burying the president on this point.
Yeah, he was distancing himself before, but now I think he has a problem, which is that he is going to have to defend himself and his conduct because
yes.
it's clear that he's not being truthful. And the way I think about this a little bit is we see this a lot when you do criminal investigations. It's a little of the admit what you can't deny and deny what you can admit. And so,
right.
you know, he wants to basically carve out his culpability according to the facts that were known, particularly this text message. But even on its face, it strains credibility because if someone sent you a text message like that and you really didn't know what was going on, you would say, what are you talking about? You know,
right.
you would immediately have this very human reaction to say, wait, what?
Right. No, but his antenna went up.
Yeah. And so he called the president because he knows what's going on and he knows that they have a problem, which is that they were just papered on the conditioning of military aid with this investigation.
We should pause for a moment to give this public service announcement about investigations. It occurs to me, this is a reason why generally in criminal investigations, prosecutors and law enforcement agents are so careful and rigorous about having people come and testify and give information in private, in secret, without letting the public know what it is that people said. You know why? So that you don't get a Sondland situation where he can piece together
yeah.
from other people's testimony and reporting and leaks, piece together tailored testimony that does exactly that, where he can walk a fine line between admitting what he has to, because he knows other people have said it and those other people are credible, and denying what he can yet deny. In the absence of this public reporting, it would be really interesting to see what Gordon Sondland says from beginning to end, not knowing. And that's the prisoner's dilemma that law enforcement relies on all the time. You don't know what the other guys are going to say. You know what the truth is. You know the other people know what the truth is. You don't know if they're lying or telling the truth, how much they revealed. And so you can get yourself in deeper and deeper soup if you lie then. But now, because a lot of this is public and it's a congressional type of hearing as opposed to a private, closed-door, typical criminal proceeding, he's walking a line, and I agree with you, it's a dangerous one.
And what do you think? I agree with you, he's in the soup. Does he still testify pursuant to the subpoena on Thursday? Because I think he potentially has liability.
So why do you think no?
I think the question is, if you think about this ultimately, and again, when it comes to the president and impeachment, we're not talking about criminal charges. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think there would be potential criminal charges if it's proven that there was yep. a conspiracy to essentially influence a foreign government in this in this way. And so I don't know whether he's thinking that, but I think if you were his lawyer,
he's gonna take five.
I don't know. I wonder if he would take five, and which is the Fifth Amendment to the United States Constitution, which says you can't be compelled to provide testimony against yourself because it could be used against him in a subsequent criminal prosecution. Now, there's no indication that there's a current grand jury. There's no indication that there is any type of criminal prosecution. But if you or I represented him as a lawyer, which we obviously don't, but if someone represented him as a lawyer, you have to be thinking about that given where this stands now.
Well, you know what? You just raised a very interesting question that we should pause to talk about. So if there's an important witness in connection with all this Ukraine business who decides in consultation with a lawyer to plead the Fifth Amendment and refuse to come testify because such testimony might incriminate that person, that's a big deal. And although in our criminal legal system, the fact of the invocation of the Fifth Amendment, as everyone knows, if you've practiced law or if you've been in, you watch TV, can't be used against the person. You can't draw any inference from the fact that someone invokes their Fifth Amendment right. But two things are also true. One, that doesn't stop the public from making a determination about why someone is pleading the Fifth Amendment, which is further buttressed by the fact that I remember seeing footage of Donald Trump himself at rallies, contrary to sort of basic principles of criminal jurisprudence in this country, said multiple times, when someone takes the Fifth, that means they're a criminal. So he has said that himself about other people in other contexts.
Fifth Amendment, Fifth Amendment, Fifth Amendment. Horrible.
If you're innocent, why are you taking the Fifth Amendment?
When you have your staff taking the Fifth Amendment, taking the Fifth so they're not prosecuted, I think it's disgraceful.
So it will be an earthquake if Gordon Sondland or someone else who otherwise is a close advisor of the president and involved in the Ukraine mess pleads the Fifth Amendment. And then the second thing I think is true, and people will write in if I'm wrong, although in a criminal case, someone's decision to plead the Fifth Amendment can't be used against that person, I don't know that that's true in impeachment. That is not governed by the normal laws of evidence. And whether or not members of the House can draw an adverse inference from not just someone's refusal to come and speak or obstruction with respect to giving documents, but even a direct invocation of the Fifth Amendment, can members of the House draw an adverse inference that you're not permitted to do in a criminal trial, but can they do it in an impeachment proceeding in a way that supports their vote in favor of impeachment?
That's a great question. And I think we're going to have to see what happens on Thursday. But the minute I read this, I thought, oof, you know, he's about to walk in. And if the House panels do a good job, Sondland will not be able to maintain this argument he was making yesterday. I believe that he didn't know anything, that he trusted Trump's response to him, that there was nothing wrong and that there was no quid pro quo. And so I think this raises a really interesting question for what happens this week in Congress. So we have a question from a listener at Preparar at Ann Milgram. In this episode, meaning the episode from last week of the hashtag Cafe Insider, you both use the term, quote, papering. What does it mean? The interwebs aren't being helpful because I don't think you're talking about wallpaper or theater tickets. Hashtag ask Preet, ask Ann. And so, you know, we do use this. It's a common sort of way people think as prosecutors and government lawyers even. But the idea of papering is that someone put something in writing so that there's a written record of something that took place. And so later it can't be denied or alleged that something else happened. It's meant to, you know, here when you think about Bill Taylor's text message, he's basically really uncomfortable with something happening. And so he decides, I'm going to explicitly say what I think is happening so that it's clear that I'm not part of this quid pro quo, this, you know, conditioning assistance to Ukraine on help with the political election. And so we talk about, you know, he and others papering things, creating a record that is independent of just a conversation so that there's some version of events that's written down. And it becomes much harder for the other side of a conversation to deny. We also saw it, frankly, with Jim Comey. After his repeated meetings with President Trump, he went back and wrote almost contemporaneous memos of what had happened. He's making a written record of what he thought had happened. And so, you know, it's something that people in government do. Not frequently, but it is something that people do when they're concerned about whether or not they may be getting involved in something they shouldn't or whether someone – if someone else is doing something they think is inappropriate.
So the removed ambassador to Ukraine, Masha Yovanovitch, testified just a few days ago, but it seems like 100 years ago, and we should talk about that for a minute. I think she set forth how much she cares about her responsibility, how much she cares about American national security. What'd you make of her testimony? And by the way, we don't have all of it. We have the opening statement, I believe.
Yeah, I think we probably only have like the tip of the iceberg on it. But she made a concerted point of saying that she was removed because of pressure that President Trump had placed on the State Department, that she had been told by the Deputy Secretary of State that she had done nothing wrong, but that there had been a coordinated campaign to get her out. And, you know, she makes this direct connection, and I thought this was one of the most important parts, and it wasn't – the reporting didn't focus that much on it, but she led efforts to bolster Ukraine's National Anti-Corruption Bureau. So that was an institution launched in 2014 aimed at fighting the corruption that is very prevalent in Ukraine. And so she made a lot of enemies, it's very clear. And she really went out of her way to basically say that she believes that she made enemies because of her work with this anti-corruption endeavor. And she basically says this is a problem for the United States because if people who have interests that are contrary, you know, people who have private financial interests, for example, that go contrary to the work of what U.S. ambassadors are doing, if they can lobby the White House and the State Department to have the ambassadors removed, it sends a terrible message worldwide that the United States, you know, essentially is open for corruption and open for business. And so she didn't use those words. I'm paraphrasing. But it was a pretty chilling warning for a member, a longtime member of the diplomatic corps to basically say, I was removed for on a political basis and essentially because I was doing anti-corruption work in Ukraine.
And there's been reporting that one of the people who complained and was on a campaign to oust her is the ubiquitous Rudy Giuliani. And I think, as we'll get to him in a moment more directly, I think Rudy is going to be a gigantic problem for the president. And this whole idea of shadow diplomacy, where you have a private citizen who is not really working in a legal capacity, although he claims that he was from time to time and other times claims that he wasn't, doing things that the State Department sometimes knew about, sometimes didn't know about, and to further the private, personal, or political interests of the president. And you have person after person saying they were alarmed by this conduct and behavior. And now you have the Southern District, and I don't want to jump ahead, but just to foreshadow, you have his former office and my former office looking at his financial dealings and everything else.
And looking at his involvement in having the Ukraine ambassador removed as well.
Yes, 100%. So, you know, it seems that the running thread through a lot of this is, you know, the rogue behavior, although maybe it was not so rogue as far as the president was concerned, but the rest of the administration is concerned, the rogue behavior of Rudy Giuliani. I want to come back to the White House counsel's letter, the Cipollone letter. I said when interviewed about this, when it first came out, that I was frankly shocked by it because there have been other White House counsel letters that I've seen from this administration and certainly from other administrations with whose logic I disagreed and whose ultimate conclusion I thought was not right. But I've actually never seen such a non-legal, poorly written, rhetorically ridiculous letter.
Yes.
George Conway was on the podcast last week, as people know, referred to it as garbage, I think, and trash.
Yeah.
And it's really stunning because you can make legal arguments, and I've never seen one as bad as this before, even when they were disagreeing with all sorts of things that the special counsel, Robert Mueller, was trying to do. From time to time, I would read those letters and say, well, I disagree. But they're putting the best face they can on their legal argument, which is what good lawyers do, what good brief writers do. And then came the news, which explained a bit of it, and I think you have a dispute about this, that Donald Trump had a big role in this letter. Now, you think he's not quite smart enough.
Here's what I think.
He's not quite smart. Wait, just so I can state your position, and then you can defend or abandon it, that Donald Trump was not quite smart enough to have written a crappy letter like this.
I definitely don't think he wrote it. Have you seen his text messages? First of all, if he wrote this memo, it would be in all caps with many spelling mistakes and grammatical errors.
So
that's number one.
They ran it through the spell check.
Number two is that it's legal-ish, right? And so
legal-ish. You heard it here, ladies and gentlemen.
The title of our memoirs.
Can you get CLE? Can you get continuing legal education credit for legal-ish?
So here's what I think he did. I think he was deeply involved, and I think what he did, and it's been reported that he brought the White House counsel into his office many times to have conversations about this letter. I think that's exactly what happened, which is Trump said, look, this is a due process violation. And remember that the president is watching Fox News, hearing these Fox legal commentators say things like, why doesn't the president get to call witnesses? And so Trump is taking some of that legal-ish argument, which again is a completely failing and non-meritorious argument, but he's taking some of that and he thinks, oh, that makes sense to me. And he's saying to the White House counsel, I want you to argue it's unfair. They're violating my due process. And then he leaves it to the White House counsel to try to craft a legal argument around this. And also the other piece of the letter, which is very much a part of Fox News and sort of the conservative media right now, is this: the House has to vote in order for there to be an impeachment proceeding, which again is not legally true.
Right, but that's at least an argument that has some foundation because there's some precedent. But my favorite part of the letter, if one can have one, is where, and I wrote about this in the Insider note in the newsletter last week, but to state it again because I think it's worth restating, they have this whole section where they're attacking basically the bona fides of the investigation, the people who are doing the investigation, one of whom is Adam Schiff. And they talk about this thing that Adam Schiff did, which was not good, where he made some statement about whether or not there had been direct contact between the committee and the whistleblower before the whistleblower complaint was filed. And it turns out that was not right. And he's apologized for it. And the Washington Post fact checker, I think, gave Adam Schiff 4 Pinocchios for that statement. And the letter goes on and on, basically saying, well, this is a great source, the Washington Post fact checker, because Adam Schiff on this point gets 4 Pinocchios. I believe it's the first time Adam Schiff has ever gotten such a thing, I believe. So if that's so, and this is such a great fact checker, and it's such a great source for determining the credibility of the speaker, one might wonder, well, did they ever make a finding about President Trump? Oh, yes. President Trump, I think over 1,000 times has gotten 4 Pinocchios. In fact, they invented a term for him called the bottomless Pinocchio for four Pinocchio claims that he has made so many times they have to have their own category. When you wish upon a star. So that's the kind of nonsense, garbage, trash thing that these guys do. They take a statement made by someone else that they have apologized for and forget that their own guy has done it 1,000 times and never apologized for it and continues to lie. Now, well, on the point about the House, yeah, go ahead.
Here's what's stunning about that is even in the context of you and I are having a conversation about a White House counsel letter about an investigation, and you and I would expect it to be filled with legal arguments. And the conversation we just had that you were just talking about is a completely political argument when they're attacking Schiff. And so it really does, to me, just sort of drive home the point of what a poorly written and reasoned letter that was. And by the way, the fact that it's being disregarded by people,
yes,
by people, yeah, in the executive branch, like the State Department, is not surprising.
But at the end of the day, it is correct that the Constitution says sole exclusive authority for impeachment vests in the House. They can do it basically how they want. I'm kind of the view that maybe Nancy Pelosi should think about having a full House vote. I know that she wants to protect some members from having to take such a vote who are in some more moderate or purple districts. But, you know, a part of me wonders if you can call the president's bluff and say, okay, fine, we'll take that vote. They have enough votes to proceed. And then takes away the principal argument I think these folks are making.
But, yeah, so I'm going to contra that a little bit. This isn't a deeply held view in my mind, but I would sort of suggest 2 things. The first is that this is just the argument of the day by the president of why this impeachment inquiry shouldn't continue. And so I think he puts up a lot of smoke screens and you can't respond to all of them. And so I understand the point that this is a significant one and you want—
But there's some precedent, right? You have to agree—
There is definitely precedent.
For taking such a vote.
There is.
I have a view about how valuable those precedents are because when you only have, you know—
Three
precedents or 2 or 3 precedents in entire history and you have facts here that are different from those facts, you know, I don't know how compelling that is. And also, at a time when, you know, they're arguing and bemoaning and whining about norms, which is what this is, in a sea of norm breaking,
right,
in every imaginable way.
Yeah, you don't get
by
to
this president,
yes,
and how he conducts policy and how he interacts with the House is a little bit rich.
Yeah, you don't get to pick the norms that you comply with and those you don't. Here's where I could see a vote being incredibly powerful, and this is a more political argument than I think a legal one. Again, legally, I don't think it's required. So there's a way in which there are shoes that continue to drop, and there is a way in which, you know, every day there's something new, that at some point something comes out that is worth forcing the Republican members of the House to go on record against, for them to basically put them in a bind where Pelosi says, you know what, there's so much evidence at this moment in time, let's call the vote, because for Republicans to vote against the inquiry would be deeply problematic for them with the public as a matter. And you know, it's hard to imagine what that would be, but there are potential other shoes that could drop in this type of an investigation and more that could come out. You know, for example, another transcript of a call, it could be a powerful tool that she has in her back pocket. But that being said, as a purely legal matter, I very strongly support the way that they're doing this investigation. And remember that in those depositions, it's Republican and Democratic members of those three House committees. Yes, the Democrats are in charge of those. They have the leadership in those committees. But the behind-the-scenes depositions and hearings are being done in a bipartisan basis. And so there's no argument in my mind that there's no participation from both sides. This is really done to sort of preserve the integrity of an investigation.
Yeah, and also, you know, this is in the way of impeachment, not conviction. So it's akin to a grand jury proceeding, which in the federal system, people know the defendant doesn't have a right to participate. And so these folks are being able to participate more than you would have in an ordinary grand jury proceeding. Are you ready to get to more Rudy Giuliani?
I'm ready.
So before we get to the fact that his associates have been charged by the SDNY and whether he's being investigated and for what, my basic question is he still the president's lawyer? The president was asked, is he your lawyer? And he's like, I haven't really talked to him. And he said, well, I did talk to him. And then he used an interesting tense when he responded. He said, he has been my attorney.
Like, yes.
Was your attorney, is your attorney, will have been your attorney?
Yes.
He has been my attorney. And I don't know that people fully appreciate this. The decision about whether or not Rudy is the president's attorney is solely in the discretion of?
The president.
The president.
Yep.
I don't know them. I don't know about them. I don't know what they do. But I don't know. Maybe they were clients of Rudy. You'd have to ask Rudy. I just don't know.
So what the hell's going on? Is he about to be pushed under the bus?
I think so. I mean, the president's answer, it was very similar to some of the answers he gave with regard to Michael Cohen when the sort of heat was on. And so, you know, I don't know. I haven't spoken to Rudy. He has been my attorney. I agree with you. The past tense nature of he has been my attorney, I would expect the president to turn very quickly on Giuliani.
But he really likes the guy. So you would have thought that after a lot of grumbling, he would have taken him off television. And he remains, except for the last few days, the president's favored pit bull on television.
Yeah, but now he's the story. And so the problem for the president, and I agree with you, the president likes Rudy going on TV and spouting off, but Rudy can't go on TV right now. I mean, he's the subject. It's been reported he's the subject of this investigation in the Southern District. And he, you know, if anyone who is Rudy's lawyer has to basically say to him, you cannot go on TV because he will be asked questions that frankly could implicate him if he answered them, depending on how he answered them, could implicate him in having committed crimes. And so he's now, in my view, he's not going to provide that benefit to the president. And he's a huge liability because – and the president has to be careful on this because obviously he had Rudy do his bidding. And now Rudy is going to say, I did the president's bidding, and has sort of gone back and forth on that but been pretty clear that he was working for the president in the capacity of this Ukrainian – the things that he was doing largely in Ukraine. And so – I really feel like for the president to keep him on, he will not be able to satisfy what the president wants, which is the, you know, late night ranting on cable news.
Which is so enjoyable. But let's talk about that for a second before we get to the actual indictment. One of the things that it looks like he's being investigated for is a violation of a statute that's not often charged. And for many years, almost no prosecutions were brought under the statute. It's called FARA, the Foreign Agents Registration Act, which basically says you have to register with the Department of Justice if you're going to do any lobbying on behalf of a foreign government. And so it looks like with respect to Ukraine and the removal of the Ukrainian ambassador, Yovanovitch, and all sorts of other things, maybe he was engaged in that kind of activity. But one of the defenses he has put forward is, which is bizarre, and I can't fully unpack it with my meager aging brain, is, well, it can't be improper and certainly can't be a crime because I was acting at the direction of the president. So how can you simultaneously be lobbying the U.S. government and also acting at the behest of the head of the U.S. government? I don't follow that.
Yeah. I mean, I think that is the best defense, though, in some ways, which is to say, okay, I didn't have to register as a foreign lobbyist because I wasn't engaged in foreign lobbying. I was working for the government, and the government has these types of negotiations all the time. Now, the problem for Rudy is that he will nowhere be registered as an agent, as an official agent of the United States government. And so being the president's personal lawyer, and this is Rudy's biggest problem, I think, on all of this, is that private citizens can't go out and essentially run shadow foreign policy for the president of the United States.
Well, maybe they can if the president says, look, there's this other thing that we talked about in a prior life relating to Michael Flynn, the Logan Act, which does criminalize, although I don't think anyone has ever successfully been charged under it.
Or not in years, yeah.
No, not in years. It essentially says that, you know, you or I can't go gallivanting around the world and conduct foreign policy on behalf of the United States because we don't have any authority to do so. But I think that that's such a violation presumes that we're doing it on our own, not that we've been told to go do it by the President of the United States. And even in the absence of that, I think it's a difficult statute to find a violation of. And so Rudy's basically like, look, maybe this is bad for the President also, because separate from his legal jeopardy, his criminal legal jeopardy, maybe this is less important for his own personal freedom, but it's important otherwise. The entire foreign policy establishment, including members of Congress, are thinking, how do you have this one guy who maybe doesn't have everything straight in his head anymore conducting serious foreign policy when you have a State Department and you have an intelligence community and you have a vice president and you have ambassadors and you have all these other people? You know, this is an answer that Stephen Miller couldn't give when asked repeatedly on one of the Sunday talk shows. Why use this guy, Rudy Giuliani, who, by the way, is doubling as your private personal lawyer to prevent you from being impeached and or getting indicted when you leave office, or you know, having Bob Mueller say that you committed a crime while in office? How is that guy also conducting foreign policy on the part of the United States? He's become a pariah, I think, in all the circles where he previously may not have been.
And just to the point about, and I do think that this is a really interesting conversation about his defense, but what's also important to remember is that the investigation is also into his financial dealings. And so where this becomes really interesting, to your point of, it's not just an outside citizen who's involved in this diplomacy. It's an outside citizen who has a large number of financial ties that right now are not transparent with people in Ukraine, with the President of the United States. He probably has other clients as well that we do not know who those clients are. And so there's this intermingling of the public good and private financial gain aspect to the Giuliani conversation that I think is going to be really, really important, because it's not just a private citizen. It's a private citizen who, in some instances, it appears may have a personal financial interest in what's happening. And so that's different. And I think that's where this distinction may ultimately lie. And frankly, I think the investigation into Giuliani is going to involve not just his actions on behalf of the U.S. government, but also his financial ties, his participation with these two individuals, Parnas and Fruman, who've been charged in the Southern District, and we'll talk about them in a minute. But it's going to be really complicated, I think, for Giuliani to just make this one argument, which is, I did this at the President's bidding.
So let's talk about that indictment, which made a lot of news and was sort of unexpected. Lev Parnas, Igor Fruman, and two others were charged with campaign finance violations. Also, interestingly, I believe Mr. Parnas runs an organization called Fraud Guarantee.
By the way, there is a lot of humor.
Make them up in the novel.
No, there is a lot of humor in these guys, and I always think about, you know, John Oliver called the Mueller investigation like stupid Watergate. This is like stupid Mafia Gate. I mean, it's almost too much.
So they engaged in activity that some people think is not the most serious thing in the world. I happen to think it is. They used straw donors in connection with a scheme to get money to a campaign committee and also to a member of Congress who's not identified in the indictment, but people have identified as Congressman Sessions from Texas. And they funneled money from basically a Russian individual without, you know, making it clear that it came from that individual. And these kinds of violations, I think, undermine fair voting and fair democracy when they happen internally, so that limits are being evaded and more money is being given than the law allows for. But it's far worse, I think, because you have outside influence, and that's something that people should be worried about and should care about, especially after the couple of years we've been through. And it's not clear to me fully the relationship that Rudy Giuliani has with Mr. Parnas and Mr. Fruman. I think he's called them business associates. He's also said on other occasions that he represented them.
Yeah. So can
we
just stop on that?
He will not be representing them in a criminal case.
can we stop on that for a second? Because
please.
In a million years, I was trying to think of examples where people have been both clients and employers, right? Are they people who work with Rudy? Do they work for Rudy? Does he represent them?
Well, if you're general counsel to a company, I guess they're your client and your employer.
I guess that's true. Yeah, I guess that's true. But this is, it's just such a weird thing. You know, at times he represents them. At other times he hires them to do this work with him. It feels very, very strange for an outside lawyer, a non-general counsel, to be in this position. Also, back to your point on how serious this is, I think sometimes you watch sort of the media around this. It felt complicated a little bit last week, and I actually don't think that this is very complicated. So I think you just did a good job of simplifying. You know, it matters who contributes to elections. We keep track of it because there are limits to how much money can be placed in it. And basically, we don't allow foreign governments to influence our elections. We wouldn't allow the, you know, one of the key parts of the Parnas and Fruman charges is that they were involved in lobbying to remove the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, who we've been talking about. Parnas, you know, we also know sort of separately, not charged, but Parnas was part of the meeting with Kurt Volker and Giuliani about Ukraine. And so, you know, there's this influence of foreign governments, and some of the money that they're pushing into elections is coming from a Russian national. And so there really is a good reason to be concerned about this and for criminal prosecutions, in my view, to be brought based on this.
And of course, what looms, as we've been talking about in other contexts for the last couple of years, is the possibility that these guys flip.
Right.
And unclear what information they have on Giuliani or anyone else, but people don't like to go to prison. And people have information possibly. And so you never know which way this is going to lead. Will they keep their mouths shut? Will they not? If they don't keep their mouths shut, do they have substantial assistance they can give to federal prosecutors? What it also assures is, unless there's some odd, you know, super quick resolution of the criminal case that's separate from impeachment, all this stuff is going to be swirling around in the news and publicly and puts the stink on all this conduct of Rudy Giuliani and others. So public sentiment may be swayed even further because these things are going to continue to come up.
And just let's talk about the flipping for a second, because there's a couple things that are I'd love to get your thoughts on. I mean, the first is, it looks like the Southern District was not going to bring this case as soon as it did, but that these two guys were hightailing it out of town on a one-way ticket. They were flying out of Dulles at night. They were supposed to be, one of them was supposed to be testifying before the committee, one of the House committees. And basically the night before, they go to Dulles Airport. The government finds out that these guys are leaving and they arrest them. And so it wasn't clear to me that they wanted this investigation, the Southern District wanted this investigation to be overt or public as quickly as it became.
Yes, I totally agree with that. And one thing I think is important to cite, I saw on social media, folks, lots of people in the immediate aftermath of the arrest speculating that this was some ploy on the part of Bill Barr or others to prevent these guys from testifying before Congress, and it was actually, you know, orchestrated in a way to benefit the president. And, you know, sometimes conspiracy theories turn out to be true. I think that was really not what was going on here. The Southern District is, as far as I can tell, acting appropriately, aggressively, and independently. And you had two guys at Dulles Airport on a plane on a one-way ticket, as you point out. I tell multiple stories like this in the book where you have to take people off, arrest them, or approach them before you've completed your investigation because you're balancing the need for more proof against the concern that they're going to flee and get hinked up and never come back again. So these theories, this was some kind of strategy to prevent them from testifying in front of the House, I think holds no water. The other interesting fact that people are bandying about, I don't know what the significance is. I don't know what the inappropriateness of it is. But people have suggested that Rudy has been paid $500,000 by these folks for some services. Unclear what.
Yeah, I think that it's been reported that the Southern District is investigating Giuliani's financial dealings, his efforts to oust the former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. And it feels to me like there's going to be a number of sort of avenues of inquiry for the Southern District to look at, but particularly who's paying Giuliani and, you know, what work he's doing. And remember also that Giuliani and these two guys, Parnas and Fruman, are also, as reported by the Associated Press, they were involved in this the sort of state gas company, Naftogratz, and this effort to oust the current CEO of that in order to export U.S. natural gas to Ukraine. And so it's not clear how much that will play a role in this. But again, it's just another subplot where there's a strong avenue of personal financial gain that's involved in the actions that people were taking at the same time as they purport to be working for the president.
Do you think at some point there'll be so many threads and so many subplots that one will actually be the theft of a penguin?
Well, if they steal a penguin, then there's definitely going to be more investigations opened into them.
I think so. That's an impeachable offense. You know, just speaking of Giuliani, we've gone a long time already, and you know, every day is like an eternity in America these days with respect to this kind of news. I don't want to lose track of one thing that happened last week, that in a different universe, in a different presidency, would be a 10 or 20 day story and more. And that is the revelation, if you believe the reporting, that once upon a time, Rex Tillerson was pressed, the former Secretary of State, was pressed by President Trump to get the Justice Department to drop the case that the United States brought against a Turkish gold trader of Iranian descent named Reza Zarrab, a case that I oversaw and I've talked about a bunch here and I talk about a bunch in my book. And Tillerson was so shocked at the request, he basically said it would be illegal to do. And he told John Kelly, the chief of staff to the president at the time, that he was not going to do it. And John Kelly, the chief of staff, said, ignore the request. That by itself
is an impeachable offense.
It's an impeachable offense. It's another example on top of all of the other examples of the president deciding to interfere with a due and proper Department of Justice investigation for what reason? We don't really know. Was it for a geopolitical reason or was it because he has Trump Towers in Istanbul? You know, these things come at us so fast and furious, all these violations of what a president is supposed to do, that, you know, we focus on sensational testimony from yesterday and forget some of the sensational reporting from 4 days ago. But people should keep that in mind because that scenario and those facts are going to come back. Oh, and the connection, by the way, to Rudy Giuliani, who's a constant threat, is Reza Zarrab, whose case was being pressed by the president himself, was represented by, among other people, Rudy Giuliani.
Yes. Yeah, it's an important point. And I think, to your point on this, you know, there's a lot more we need to know about this, but on its face, it's yet another effort by the president to basically alter and sway a criminal prosecution. And it really is so significant. And it is a little bit lost in this conversation right now because it's almost like a sea of misconduct and corruption that it's hard for things to sort of bubble up. But no question that this potentially could come back. And it's a really interesting question also of whether Tillerson will provide, this has now been reported by Bloomberg, but it would be really interesting to see if Tillerson comes forward.
Yeah. And you know, with the sea of what did you call it? Sea of corruption?
Yes.
That's a good movie title, I think. But it becomes harder and harder, I think, for them, the president's supporters, to say with a straight face, this is all BS, because the whistleblower from a long time ago may have some political bias that also remains unproven.
Yeah.
Like this idea, after you have this avalanche of corroborating information, including basically a confession out of the mouth of the president himself, he still continues to tweet that we must know the identity of the whistleblower. Rudy Giuliani, at one point, you know, the thousandth time he's made me shake my head in recent days and weeks, says, you know, what kind of crazy system can we have if the whistleblower is allowed to testify in Congress anonymously or with, you know, the voice altered to protect his person, to protect his safety? And I tweeted out at the time, you know, someone should ask Rudy if, when he was mayor and also U.S. attorney, if undercover cops at the NYPD testified exactly in that way and fashion with his full support on a regular basis. You know what? They did. So that's the system that we have in place. Courts have endorsed it. Rudy Giuliani has allowed it to happen and wanted it to happen when he was mayor. So in addition to getting a lot of facts wrong, his memory needs some checking too.
Yeah, and I don't want to suggest that the whistleblower is irrelevant, because the whistleblower came forward, obviously provided hugely important information to start the investigation. But at this point, virtually everything that the whistleblower has put into the complaint has either been corroborated or is being investigated. And so at some point, you know, the president wants to make this about the whistleblower because it makes it a lot easier to sort of focus complaints and allegations of unfairness. But the truth is, it's people from the president's own State Department, people from the president's own White House. It's the president himself. I mean, there's so much evidence that is piling up around the allegations that the whistleblower first levied that, again, the whistleblower is still important, but the idea that this is about the whistleblower is completely absurd.
Do you think all of this is a wide-ranging distraction so that we avert our eyes from what is really going on here, and that is that the president still wants to buy Greenland?
Well, this is a very interesting question, Preet. Yeah, it's a very interesting question.
All right. There's like 20 more things we could talk about, but I think we should end there. And there's a lot more testimony coming this week. We'll see if Sondland testifies or not, whether he invokes the Fifth Amendment or not. And there will be, I predict, 10 other crazy things that are at this moment, things that we would not be able to predict.
I think it's worth noting that the president has been focused on many, many things, including tweeting out frequently about the impeachment inquiry and all the others that are involved. But he has not been too busy to tweet out a vote of confidence for Sean Spicer. On Monday, October 14th, Trump tweeted, quote, "Vote for good guy at Sean Spicer tonight on Dancing with the Stars. He has always been there for us." Now, it's an important vote, and it's important that the president, in the midst of everything, is taking time to support Sean Spicer in his bid to be the next winner of Dancing with the Stars.
Do you know why he's focusing on it? He believes, like most Americans do, that elections have consequences.
And he hopes that someday he, too, can be a candidate on Dancing with the Stars.
Yeah. I'm troubling. I'm not to live quite that long in my 31-year-old youth. Thanks. Thanks for a great conversation once again, Anne.
Great to chat with you. Please send us your questions.
This is the Cafe Insider Podcast. Your hosts are Preet Bharara and Anne Milgram. The executive producer is Tamara Sepper. The senior producer is Aaron Dalton. And the Cafe team is Carla Pierini, Julia Doyle, Calvin Lord, David Kurlander, and Jeff Eisenman. Our music is by Andrew Dost. Thank you for being a part of the Cafe Insider community. Hey, Stay Tuned listeners. As many of you know, Stay Tuned is going on tour. You can find all the details about our stops at cafe.com/tour. But I'm excited to announce that we've added two new guests who will join me in Denver and Detroit. We'll be in Denver on Thursday, October 24th, where former Colorado governor, recent presidential candidate, and now candidate for Senate, John Hickenlooper, will speak with me about the current political moment. Then our previously announced guest, Shannon Watts, founder of Moms Demand Action, will impart her wisdom on gun control, fighting the NRA, and what it takes to inspire a grassroots movement. Then on Tuesday, November 12th, we'll be headed to Detroit. There, I'll be joined by my one-time colleague, former Detroit U.S. Attorney Barbara McQuaid. She'll join me on stage to talk about strains on the rule of law under Trump, congressional efforts to hold the president accountable, and the outlook for impeachment. Michigan's Attorney General Dana Nessel will speak with me about the most pressing local issues and her efforts to challenge the Trump administration's policies on climate, immigration, and health care. That's in Detroit on November 12th. Get tickets to these shows at cafe.com/tour, and don't forget to check out our stops in Minneapolis, November 5th, with Mayor Jacob Frey, and in Atlanta, December 4th, where I'll be speaking with former acting Attorney General Sally Yates. cafe.com/tour. That's cafe.com/tour. I hope to see you all there.